Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. 20 years ago, on April 20th, 1999, was the Columbine High School massacre, carried out by two high school seniors, Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold. 13 people were killed that day. Harris and Klebold died by suicide while at the school. Columbine was really the beginning of a rapid rise in school shootings, and there were many questions after the massacre, some of which fell on the parents of the shooters.
They're in the garage making these things. Where the hell were their parents?
How do you have a 15-year-old son in your basement making bombs, dressed in black trench coats, part of this subculture, and not know it?
A new documentary, American Tragedy, which premieres at the Boston Film Festival tonight, tries to answer those questions. It profiles Sue Klebold, Dylan's mother, before and after the Columbine massacre. And Sue Klebold joins me now on the phone from Colorado. Sue, thank you for joining us on Radio Boston.
Thank you, Tiziana.
Also with me in studio is Boston-based film director Josh Sabe. American Tragedy was produced by Parents to Parents, a nonprofit focused on mental health. Josh, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks.
This is a difficult subject, but I want to kind of jump right in. Josh, as you prepared to make this film, tell us about getting to know Sue. What did you expect from or about her as you began?
You know, I think Andrew Solomon experienced a similar thing. He talks about this, where you go in, maybe you have some expectations that you're going to, you know, have some insight maybe into what happened, you know, why Dylan participated in this, you know, see maybe some problems. But that's definitely not the experience you have meeting Sue. She's wonderful. She's classy. She's kind. So she's a lovely, wonderful person to get to meet, and it was a privilege to get to know her.
Sue, we really appreciate you speaking with us. We heard a montage of the news coverage during shortly after the time of Columbine. It's questioning. It's accusing you for not knowing what your son was doing. You say in the film, when reflecting on tragedy, that we need to blame after an incident like this. In those early months, who or what did you blame?
In those early months, I was so bewildered and so heartbroken. I didn't really have any blame because I was simply trying to understand what had happened, how my son came to be there, because I was in a lot of denial about his being there, because the Dylan that I knew and loved would not do something like this, and he was kind and he was funny. I wasn't experiencing blame. I was just experiencing heartbreak and humiliation and terror because of all the hatred being leveled against us.
Sue, you talk in the film about the fact that about 6 months later, you learn the results of the police investigation, and it debunks or challenges this narrative you've been telling yourself in your head.
Yes. At about 6 months after the tragedy, the sheriff's department released a report. And I remember when I went to this report, I had a notebook with me, and it had all these questions about, you know, how did Dylan get to be there? You know, who convinced him to do this? And what I learned from that shocking report was that this had been planned, that he had been a willing participant, that their goal was to kill everyone in the school. And I just remember at that meeting being almost physically ill. I remember at one point standing up and trying to decide if I needed to run out of the room or not. It was really put me into a flight mode. I just could hardly bear what I was hearing. So it was a shock, and it really caused me to tear down everything I'd been clinging to and really start the grief process all over, because people had been calling my son a monster. And for the first time, I think I really understood just how monstrous it was.
I want to play a cut from the film from Liza Long. She's a mother and an author who had a viral post about behavior she was worried about in her own son after the shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary. Here she reflects on Columbine.
Whatever lessons we should have learned from Columbine, I would say, unfortunately, we did not. And that's why we keep repeating this very uniquely American tragedy.
Sue, you have remarkably and bravely gone through a process of reflecting in the years since. What lessons did we learn or should we have learned from Columbine?
I think over 20 years, there are probably more lessons than I can count. One of the very important lessons I hope we have learned or that we are beginning to learn, after the Columbine tragedy, it was the beginning of 24/7 news coverage. Without knowing it, that launched, kind of cemented Columbine in our consciousness as a symbolic gesture, perhaps, of, you know, good and evil. And really, this is not the case when something like this happens. It is about many things that converge. And certainly I have learned over the years that to understand how a tragedy such as this happens, we can never say it's because of one thing. It is not because of bullying, of video games, of psychiatric medications. It's never one thing. We don't have to be able to predict who is going to commit some kind of a violent act, but we can certainly prevent. For example, we have learned that school shooters very often are suicidal, and my own son, I learned after his death, had been suicidal and was writing about it. And if we could have addressed his suicidality, I truly believe that we might have prevented at least his involvement in the tragedy.
Can I comment
on
this?
Yeah, in fact, I was going to ask you the same question, Josh. You had the opportunity to look deeply at the Columbine shooting, but with some perspective and distance. And what did you learn?
Yeah, so Dave Cullen, the author of Columbine, has also said that, you know, dealing with teenage depression is one of the great unlearned lessons of Columbine. And I think Sue's story is particularly interesting on this point because she was completely surprised. You know, she was as surprised as the rest of us. And, you know, she's, you know, gone through her past. You know, she talks about going through every possible interaction she remembers, you know, trying to find something. And, you know, she has discovered some things. She's, you know, discovered that her son was depressed. She didn't know that. She discovered that he was deeply suicidal. She didn't know that. And maybe what's so surprising is that there wasn't something obvious. There weren't these obvious signs that she should have spotted. And so the question of the documentary becomes, how do you stop something that's so invisible so often?
Well, let's talk about that invisibility for a minute, too. Here is Sue in the film reflecting on the fact she didn't think her son could be suicidal.
I remember certainly going to health fairs, and I'd see a table, and they might have suicide prevention materials on there. I would walk right past it because I'd say, this doesn't apply to me. No one I love would ever die by suicide because I love them too much, and I wouldn't let that happen. I see now that many other people do that too.
As somebody who viewed the film, it was really striking that it truly became about mental health, mental well-being, depression, suicide prevention. When were the moments where you came to understand that that was what this experience was truly about?
I think we came into it interested about this topic. I don't think we knew the answers we would get. Lots of people are scared that their child might be a school shooter. You know, that's a very small possibility. And it's even a small possibility that your kids will be in a school shooting. But it's a very large possibility that they'll deal with something like depression or anxiety. These are things we actually can do things about, and we can often prevent if we start early enough. Right now, all of our resources are going into treatment. We have a treatment-focused model. So someone, you know, might develop almost invisibly, like Dylan, a mental illness, and we don't even start treating it until it's entrenched. But if we start beforehand, if we start teaching mental health skills, we can have a much better outcome. We can have targeted campaigns that teach parents how to teach skills, you know, to deal with anxiety, you know, breathing skills, mindfulness skills, skills that can make a huge difference in their life and are proven to prevent anxiety and depression in our children.
Sue, is it fair to call you a mental health advocate? And if it is, when do you think you became one?
Oh, I suppose it's fair. My own path of discovery, when I learned that Dylan had written in a journal 2 years prior to his death that he was in agony and wanted to die and was cutting himself, and I was so shocked to hear that, and I couldn't believe that while I was experiencing what seemed like a normal and fulfilling life, he was suffering so greatly. But what we have to be careful of is that not everyone who experiences depression is suicidal, and not everyone who is suicidal is depressed. It is far more complicated than that. And so we want to be careful before we even start this discussion that becoming a mental health advocate, I sort of put that in air quotes because I use the term in my book of being a brain health advocate or being a mental wellness advocate, because we don't yet know enough about these boundaries that get crossed when someone is on a path towards self-destruction. So we must be very careful about pinning all the blame on mental illness when we talk about tragedies such as this.
Both of you have talked about this is a rare circumstance. And Sue, you've thoughtfully pointed out that there is not a direct overlap between what we would traditionally refer to as mental illness and the tendency to be violent or to commit acts like this. At the same time, mental wellness talks about the responsibilities early on to help children learn healthy mental health habits, et cetera. There was a piece of me that thought in watching it, in some ways, doesn't that also put staggering pressure on parents, especially when one of the points you make over and over again in the documentary is how much parents may not know what their young people are experiencing?
Well, see, I would hope it does the opposite, because I think it's much more stressful to be sitting as a parent wondering, I hope I love my kids enough. I hope I'm being a good parent in this abstract, you know, idea, and they're going to avoid all of these problems. It's much more reassuring to feel empowered with things that are proven to help kids avoid common problems like depression, like anxiety, and to know that there are things that can be taught.
This film deals with mental well-being, but it doesn't go in depth on guns. Josh, why not?
We do mention it, that we should address it. It's not the angle, it's not the approach that we're talking about in this documentary. And I think what's a tragedy is that these issues have been split up as either or instead of both and, particularly because they actually inform and speak to each other. You know, by far the most number of gun-related deaths are suicide. And so if we're going to prevent deaths, you know, gun-related deaths, we should be thinking about the mental health aspects of it. And so these issues are interrelated, they're connected, and politically they've been separated, and that's really too bad.
All right, so for both of you, the film is going to premiere. A lot of people are going to see this. What would your message to families be today?
I believe that the message that I have taken away from this and that I share with people is, and that is the subtitle of the movie, and that is love is not enough. I think we believe when we hug our children and tell them we love them, that we are connecting with them. But I hope people will realize that someone's internal experience on the receiving end of that love might be very different from what we are thinking it should be and what we project it to be.
And Josh Shaby, what's the message you want people to take away from American Tragedy?
One is to drop the simple answers, have empathy for people like Sue, and ultimately an empowerment and hope. That for our own kids, there's hope there. We can dramatically decrease depression, suicidality, a lot of these issues, and that would be a huge benefit to society. And it's just so much more personal than that. You know, talking about a society, it feels abstract, but just in general, like you have children.
Yep.
And I can I ask the question back to you? What was your takeaway?
My takeaway from the documentary was, deeply check in with and engage with your kids and help them deal with the emotional aspect of their lives the same way I support them in dealing with homework and their physical health and the other parts of their lives.
Yeah, I think there's a great line that Sue says in the documentary where she says she taught Dylan, you know, dental hygiene. She taught him financial responsibility. But she didn't even know really that she should be teaching brain health or be aware of that or teaching him how to notice his emotions. You know, that wasn't even part of her, you know, her paradigm. And that's been one of I think that's her biggest regret.
And I advise people all the time, stop talking and just allow our loved ones to feel what they feel, express what they are feeling, and help them deal with those feelings. And I don't think most of us do a very good job of that.
That's mother and advocate Sue Klebold. Sue, thank you for joining us on Radio Boston.
Thank you.
And Boston-based film director Josh Sabe. Thank you, Josh.
Thanks.
Listeners, if you or someone you know may be considering suicide, contact the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255. Or you can text the Crisis Text Line at 741-741. American Tragedy will premiere at the Boston Film Festival tonight at 7. More information is on our website, radioboston.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston.